Hey, it's Glenn Washington, the host of the Snap Judgment Podcast. And at Snap, each and every week, we drop you into someone else's world. Feel what they feel. Duck when they duck. Weep when they weep. And laugh when they laugh. Surprising, cinematic, it's raw. Stories that connect us all. We go there each and every week because we found that it is hard to hate someone if you know their story. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Each and every week, listen wherever you get your podcasts.
To succeed in the future of work, forward thinkers use AI to deliver measurable results. Workday is the AI platform for HR and finance that frees you from the mundane so you can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward.
Hey, Borderly fam, welcome back. Mario Carrillo here, your host of Borderly, a project of Immigrantly. I hope that you're all taking care. And I want to thank you, first of all, for staying with me on this journey of exploring borders and boundaries and the people who live among them and between them. We're on our third episode today, and our first two with Dr. Leyva, oral historian at UTEP, and Bob Moore of El Paso Matters, I hope have provided you context, history, and the nuance needed to better understand life in El Paso and in Ciudad Juarez. At Borderly, my goal has been to shine a spotlight on El Paso, my beloved hometown, and to show that it is much more than the headlines you might be familiar with. And as I've mentioned in previous episodes, I moved back to El Paso in late 2024 with my wife and our daughter. But of course, that time I was away, I would visit frequently to spend the holidays with my family for weddings. But I haven't lived here permanently since I was 20. And I think since being back, one of the things that I've noticed this time around that maybe I hadn't been as open to when I lived here was our city's art scene. So for this episode, I spoke to Patrick Gabaldon, an incredible artist and lawyer, born and raised here in El Paso. And one of the stories that I mentioned to him during our interview was about my wife, the first time she flew into El Paso. She's not from here. And she mentioned how brown everything seemed as she was landing. And I think that could be one of the things that strike you the most as you're landing in El Paso is the lack of color that you see, and how all-encompassing the varying shades of brown feel as you land, surrounded by the mountains and the desert. But she also mentioned that once you're on the ground, walking the city streets, that the color is really all around you. And that's what Patrick, at least for me, I feel, has accomplished with his art. It's very vibrant and very, very colorful. And actually, if you find yourself flying into El Paso, you'll be lucky enough to immediately find Patrick's work all around you throughout the airport. And I talked to Patrick about growing up here in El Paso, how he left for law school, but then eventually came back. I think it's one of those themes that we've touched on during our first two episodes on how many of us leave and many of us do find our way back one way or another. But we also talked about our city's incredible and, frankly, what I think underrated art scene and how artists today are putting El Paso on the map. Plus, we get a small bonus of hearing of his own family's long roots to the border and some incredible stories that he shared about his own family and how he even finds it difficult to separate what may or may not be true and what may or may not be folklore from his family's stories, which I think is something that those of us who are from here can relate to. But I hope you enjoy our conversation with Patrick.
Hey,
love to hear of your earliest memories of growing up on the border and what that was like for you.
Sure. My guess is it was like a lot of people that were born here. My family goes back pretty far to the area. My dad's family was mostly from Fabens. My grandfather and his side was a farm worker. So they were in Texas. The story goes when it was an independent country, before it was Texas, when it was still part of Mexico, their family was here and worked different farmlands from Mexico all the way up to parts of like Colorado and even further north. They settled in Rice, Texas, and then eventually moved to Tornillo. My mom's family is from Durango and the Chihuahua area. My grandparents were raised here also. They go back pretty far, the El Paso connection. The story goes, my mom's mom, her father, my great-grandfather Joe, was a youngish boy, I guess, during the Mexican Revolution. And he worked for Pancho Villa in some capacity that maybe the story is that he didn't really love working for Pancho Villa. At one point stole a purse of some money that they were collecting some quotas from different businesses. And he took the bag of money and walked over to El Paso and never went back.
Whoa, wait, how did you end up hearing that story? Is that just been passed down over generations?
They just used to tell it. I mean, it was just one of the family stories. I mean, it's hard to say how much truth there is to it. My grandma is notorious for saying all sorts of things that were kind of half true or you never knew. She was a big storyteller. So we tell the story, but all of us in the family kind of like, well, I mean, you know, grandma told it. So who knows the real story there? But the story goes, yeah, and she was proud to tell everybody. She's like, yeah, my father worked for Pancho Villa. He collected money for him, was one of his runners for money. And one day he took a bag of cash that he was collecting and he walked over to El Paso and never went back.
Wow. Yeah, your family story has a little bit of everything that includes the border, including the revolution, including run-ins with Villa.
Yeah, it's a great story. Who knows? Maybe a bunch of other families have the same story and the same guys told it to everybody. You know, who knows what the truth there is. But that's the family story. You know, at one point, he helped paint the sky in the Plaza Theater when they were first opening, just as like a painter, not as necessarily as like an artisan, but as one of the many painters they hired to paint the night sky in the Plaza Theater, the original night sky inside.
Yeah. And so those who are unaware of El Paso, it's a beautiful theater that's still open to this day in downtown that shows movies and music. So that's awesome. What an incredible story.
My grandfather ended up going to Texas Western.
Yeah.
He graduated in 1965.
Oh, right before they won the championship. Yeah.
Before they won the championship. I mean, a story he told me many times was that, yeah, when he was a student, he got A's in most of his classes, but in his speech and debate class, he got a C, and he was confused. And he went to the teacher. He was like, why'd I get a C? What's, you know, my grades all year were good. And she said, well, you still speak with that South El Paso accent, and this is speech. And, you know, anybody that gets an accent, that has an accent, is getting a C in my class, no matter your grades.
Oh, wow. So it didn't even matter the subject matter. It was all about the accent.
Yeah, it was all about the accent. We've been here for so long. The culture is in our family blood. I think it stretches far and wide, the good and the bad, right? Those stories of like assimilation and assimilating, but also the like push and pull of what the border is at different times, how the history is shaped and changed. Now I'm a small part of the current El Paso, I don't know, movement, culture, community.
I'd argue that you're bigger than a small part of it, though, but that's incredible. And life for you, what was like in the 90s growing up here? Did you ever cross back to Juarez for any reason, any doctor's appointments, or did you spend most of your time here in the north?
Yeah, we spent most of our time here. We crossed back and forth like to go to the markets and the fairs and all that kind of stuff. My grandparents grew up in Segundo Barrio. They lived by Escarita Park, so they were relatively close. But we did most of our stuff here. A lot of driving on I-10 and looking over into Juarez and our parents saying like, you know, just luck of the draw where you're born. You know, we're all one community and the kids there are just like you. And that's how life is. And you need to remember that just because someone's on another part of the border or has a different life doesn't make you any different or any more special or less special because of where you're from. And most of our family was here. I mean, there were still family there, but over the years, everyone had pretty much made their life here in El Paso off Alameda. And then my dad's ranching family, they were all out in Fabens. So.
No, that's incredible. El Paso through and through. To what extent, or at what point, and maybe this came later in life, but did you notice that there was something unique about growing up in what almost feels like a mythical place? I think if you tell people that you're from the border, they don't really have a sense of place or where exactly it is or what exactly it means. So was it something that you acquired later in life, or did you know it early on that, yeah, there's something unique about being able to see across and there being another country? It still, you know, it astonishes me to this day.
Yeah, really young, whenever we would go visit family that had lived in Austin or San Antonio, it always just kind of shocked me, even as a young kid, just being like, how do you know where you're going? You don't have a mountain. There's no border. How do you know when you've taken a wrong turn? How do you know you're leaving the city? How do you orient yourself when you're just surrounded by all these trees? You look up and you can't see in front of you. That always stuck with me, even when I was really young. But it didn't really hit me, the uniqueness, the difference, the special nature of the border, until I was an adult and had moved out, you know, moved away, and had people bringing their own perspective or their own thought of what El Paso was or the border was, which was usually in direct conflict of the place I had in my mind and the life I had lived here. For better or worse, you know, just people that had no clue, just like I had no clue about where they were from. I mean, I say I was an adult. I was already in law school when I was confronted with that, because I went to school at UTEP here in El Paso. And so it was much more the same, right? Just meeting more kids, like different El Paso kids most of the time from somewhere else in the city. Even though I never lived in the Northeast, I mean, or the West Side or whatever, everyone still got tamales for Christmas and still went to the park on Mother's Day or whatever.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And I feel like we definitely grew up in something of a bubble here. And I had similar experiences to you when I first left. And I realized that not every city has people that look like us. It was kind of a shock to me. I did my undergrad studies in San Antonio, so it wasn't as shocking. But when I moved to Austin and I lived in Washington and I've lived in other places in the U.S., it's certainly much more stark, the differences between El Paso and the rest of the country. But as you mentioned, I think it's almost like a rite of passage that those of us who grew up here, we have this, and I don't know if this is true for you, but like almost a desire to leave and explore and find something about ourselves. But there's always something drawing us back to the border. So you left, as you mentioned, and it was likely to go to law school. Is that the major reason? And after you finished, did you always know that you would come back, or you had no idea that that would be where your career would lead you?
Yeah, I didn't know we would come back. My wife and I are both from here, and so we wanted to go and explore. I mean, she had a life before me, so she lived in Austin, and she lived in New York for a minute. She came back to El Paso. But we never had any thought that we were definitely moving back home. It was just kind of a circumstance that was laid in front of us, and we were like, shoot, I guess we're going back to El Paso. And yeah, with a new perspective on the appreciation we saw, I never grew up kind of wanting to go. I mean, I didn't have a desire to stay. I didn't have a desire to go. I'm just kind of sort of go with the flow ish a little bit, at least. So I never quite thought too much about it. I had cousins that knew since my earliest memory, they were telling me like, I'm out of here, man. Like the minute I turn 18, I'm going to college and I'm never coming back. And my sister was that way too. And yeah, they were right. They you know, they don't come back. They've never come back.
There isn't that same pull for every single person, though.
Yeah, right. Like I was kind of indifferent of leaving or coming or whatever, but when we moved away, it definitely brought a new appreciation for where we were from and a new lens in which to view ourselves, to view the place, to view our family, to view our histories, or just things that we thought were normal that were not, you know, that were very special or unique. It was a good time to go to law school out of town. Obviously, University of Texas El Paso doesn't have a law school, so I had to go away to study. And a couple of times when I was at UTEP, I did some like courses, kind of competition things where we would travel. And that was always an eye-opening experience. Even though we traveled a little bit as kids, we mostly went to other places in Texas or California, kind of. So you still see a lot of gente everywhere you go. But going up to the Northeast for different things and looking around and being like, oh, wow, like my friends from Juarez or from Cuauhtémoc or wherever that are all part of the UTEP group, we're pretty different from, you know, the different groups of students from all over.
As you mentioned, you are a lawyer by trade. And explain to me, first of all, how your career trajectory has gone from when you began as a lawyer to where you are today. And to what extent did this career path end up defining your next one as an artist? Was it almost an escape for you once you started painting?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was an emotional, mental escape that, you know, falling sort of on my lap and then now with clear intention. But yeah, when I decided to go to law school, it wasn't something that I had been thinking of my whole life. It wasn't a goal I had. I didn't know this till much later as an adult, again, that I had family members that were lawyers and my mom's cousins that I just didn't really know. And turns out they were lawyers. I wish I had known when I was in law school that I had lawyers I could have called and asked questions of. But yeah, when I was at UTEP, I took some of these like mock UN classes. And I took some law classes because I just thought they were really interesting. They were hard. I wasn't good at them. I didn't get good grades. They were my for sure lowest grades every time I took one of those courses, but I really enjoyed them. My grandfather used to tell me that he wished he would have gone to law school, but the times, you know, he was in the Korean War and he graduated from college, but like his life ended up differently. And he would always talk about how that's something he wished he could do. And when I met my wife at UTEP, she really encouraged me to keep taking those like difficult courses. And then like one day a professor was like, hey, you're doing pretty good in my class. Have you ever contemplated maybe going to law school? You know, you're not afraid to speak to groups. You put forth good work product. I think, you know, you could make a career out of it. And on a whim, it was kind of like, all right, well, I never thought that as an option for me. I'm not the kind of person I would look at and think, oh yeah, that's someone that's going to go to law school and be a lawyer. I just didn't see myself that way. Part of me still doesn't.
But yet here you are.
Here I am, been practicing since 2011. But yeah, it was kind of like an accident thing. I was like, all right, well, baby steps. That's kind of how I view things in life. So, hey, baby steps. I'm encouraged to take these courses. I really like them. They're tough and they're fun. So I'm going to take some more law classes and I will take the LSAT exam. I found out through the grapevine there was like an LSAT prep course that was being kind of taught on the down low by a professor who only let certain students know. I found out on accident, kept showing up every morning. He wasn't too happy. He kicked me out, told me it didn't exist, but I kept showing up. Turns out, you know, it was a thing. He let me stay, took the LSAT, and it was like, if I can get a decent enough score, then I'll apply to all the schools that waive their application fees because I had no money and they're very expensive. Delivering pizzas, I was a substitute teacher. Also, I was at UTEP, so had little money for paying for like $100 application fees. So I applied everywhere that was free. I went and did an interview at University of Arizona. I applied at St. Mary's in San Antonio because my wife's brother lived there. And I thought, you know, some family there. I know the city. It's close, but not close. Take the bar in Texas and all that. And if I fail and flunk out, well, you know, San Antonio's not such a bad place to be.
Yeah, and not that different from El Paso too, you're right.
Yeah, not too different depending on where you're at. So it was another baby step, man. It was like I got waitlisted at St. Mary's and, you know, people encouraged me like, oh, take the LSAT again, get a better score. And I was like, yo, law school was not something I dreamed of. But when I was in law school, I had an opportunity to intern at Raices. Mm-hmm. They're like an immigration nonprofit.
Of course. Yeah.
They were pretty new back then. It was the early founders. And it was what, like four lawyers and mostly cancellation of removal and adjustment status stuff. And I worked for them as an intern for probably about a year. And it was great. I loved it. And I learned really quick when I started law school that, yeah, I wasn't going to do like bankruptcy and title and oil and gas. I wanted to really help people. And the law kind of opened up this avenue to help people in a real way. And so after doing some immigration work at Raices, I then got a job at Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid, still in law school. And so basically we were like an intake program. Every call that came in, we answered. And we talked to tons of people every day, trying to help them. We did what I call the people's law, right? So like eviction, divorce, child custody, employment stuff. We helped people with social security benefits. I mean, if it was like a normal person, the kind of law, we did it. Some immigration and some criminal. And I loved it. I mean, I loved working at Legal Aid. And that kind of, you know, opened the door for my mind of like, all right, I want to do public interest law. Whatever that is, I don't know. But I wanted to do something to help people. And then after graduating, thank God, studied hard, took the bar. Thankfully, I passed it my first go around. And I was still at Legal Aid at the time, but they weren't hiring. There's like a young guy from Austin and young women lawyers from San Antonio, a couple from the Valley. And we all really wanted to stay with Legal Aid, but, you know, nonprofit law, they don't have spots.
Yeah, it's tough. Real tough.
It's just tough, you know. And my wife's job in San Antonio was kind of ending. I was just applying everywhere, man. But I wasn't from there. And I didn't really know people. When I could get in the room, it'd be fun. They'd do well. We'd have a good time. The interviews would go well. But when you're competing with students that are also recent graduates that went to UT or Stanford or wherever and had really high GPAs, it was just, you know, why would you take a flyer on some low GPA graduate from St. Mary's? And so I started applying to jobs in El Paso. And the first three jobs that I applied for, I got three offers because the El Paso lawyers were just like, look, and organizations, they wanted people from El Paso because I know now that when you're hiring out here, if you're not hiring somebody from here or with a husband or wife from here, most people come for a year or two and then they leave. And so I got a couple offers and I wanted to be in court. So I took a job at the district attorney's office. Never wanted to do criminal law. Was not something I wanted to even entertain. I didn't take the extra criminal classes. I didn't do clinic in law school in the criminal course. But there I was saying, yeah, I'll go work at the DA's office. And I loved it.
At what point did you become a public defender then?
I'd always wanted to work for the public defender's office. I always respected my colleagues in the public defender's office. I liked working with them because as the DA, you know, you spend more time with the defense lawyers than you do your own colleagues. And I just always really respected the work that they did. I never had a public defender across from me that wasn't prepared, that wasn't kind, that wasn't doing all they could do for their clients. And I always respected that. And when the time came, truly, man, I left the DA's office with the full intent to pursue my art career in a more like serious, I mean, I consider it pretty serious, but I was like, no, I'm going to go all in for like 6 months, chase every opportunity, say yes to the things I say no to because of time and give it a go. I resigned. I sent the letter in. And within about an hour, I got a call from the public defender's office saying, hey, man, we heard you submitted your resignation. You know, we know you've wanted to come work here in passing just over the years. We got a position. Do you want to come work here? And I was like, no, I'm, you know, doing my art, trying to do that full time. And I want to give myself an opportunity and I need some time off. I'm burnt out. Trying cases is hard. It's a lot. And they said, hey, we'll take as much time as you need. We'll keep the position open for you. And I was like, wow, okay, that's kind of an opportunity you can't say no to. So I jumped at it.
Yeah, you were in demand, Patrick. Yeah.
And I love it. I've been doing it almost for 4 years now, and I love it. It's helping people immediately every single day, oftentimes going through some of the worst experiences of their lives and trying to be there to be honest and compassionate and to help. You know, part of me wishes I would have done it sooner because I really do love it. The people are great too because everyone's trying to help. So it breeds a special kind of person with a special level of empathy and sympathy and caring. So it makes for a really great environment to be in. And yeah, they're super supportive of my artwork too, you know? And so yeah, they all kind of happened at once. I mean, I didn't start painting till after I had moved to El Paso. So like we moved to El Paso in 2012 and we didn't have much to do or whatever. We're just kind of getting our feet back under us, moving back home. I wanted to live near downtown to experience a different kind of El Paso than far east side suburb living that I did as a kid. And we got invited to a paint and drink wine situation, you know, where it's like bring your own bottle or whatever. And I don't know, $40 and you paint. I did the little painting that you were supposed to do, but I kind of did my own thing. And the teacher was like, hey, man, this is really good. You should keep painting. And I thought like, nah, I mean, like, I mean, thank you. I guess we'll come back one day, but.
You thought they were just trying to get you back in there to spend another $40.
Yeah. Yeah. Business tactic. Like tell everybody that they're getting a gold star, you know?
Have you ever gone back to that place, by the way, to let them know?
I haven't, but shoot, I should. I don't even know if they still do it. I think it was like they were trying it out. New, they were like a winery out in Sullen Park, New Mexico. I don't even think they did it after like a month after we did it.
Oh, that is unfortunate, but you'd have quite a story to tell.
When people ask, I tell them, I'm like, yeah, it was Sullen Park Winery. Like, I don't know if they still do this thing. But yeah, so I painted one painting at that thing. They recommended I keep painting. And then that year, like a couple months later, the holidays were coming up. And my wife was like, you know, we don't really have much to buy gifts, but we can go buy some paint and just like paint little canvas things for our family. And it's extra meaningful. And I was like, yeah, that's a great idea. Set up in the living room and we painted these gifts for our siblings and our parents. And Christmas Day, my mom posted the picture, the one I gave her and my dad. And a friend saw it on Facebook and was like, yo, can you paint one for me? I'd love to get one for my wife. I was like, yeah, okay, cool. First painting.
First commissioned painting there.
And then I must have, God, then it just kind of blew up from there. I work at the courthouse, so people had some disposable income and needed art on their walls. And, you know, it happened to where like once a week I would bring in a new painting just to hang in my office, just to kind of, you know, I really liked it. So I kept painting up.
Give it color. Give your office some color.
Yeah, because I had nothing, man. I had nothing in my office. So I didn't even have my degree or my license up. I just got lucky with different lawyers to be like, hey, man, I heard you paint. Like, can you paint me one? And before I knew it, I was just painting tons. And then it just kind of kept leveling up, eventually having to take it way more seriously for good reason. But the support was just like overwhelming.
Olivia Culpo here to tell you all about the launch of the new Abercrombie Spring Denim Collection, made the way denim should feel. Their denim has always been a staple in my wardrobe and has a wide range of fits, styles, and washes. Every jean is available in both their classic fit and viral curve love. Shop in the app, online, and in stores.
Abby's just woken up. It's 7:31 and she's forgotten to ring the doctor. There's no point ringing now. She needs to get to work. But she's not worried. She's got an HSBC Premier bank account with access to digital GP appointments, plus 2 second opinions a year, should she need them. Everything's Premier when your bank account is. Search HSBC Premier. HSBC UK, opening up a world of opportunity.
The doctor will see you now.
Apply with £100,000 annual income or £100,000 savings or investments with HSBC UK or Premier status abroad.
Your artwork specifically, knowing that it's famous for its vibrant colors that you choose to work with. For the folks who are not familiar, I encourage you to go check out Patrick's art. And I'm curious, having grown up here, my wife, who's not from here, she's from Salt Lake City. She jokes with me that the first time that she ever flew into El Paso, there was just no color. I mean, if you're flying in during the day, you have the city and then you have the mountains and it's just varying shades of brown that you're seeing. But then she also mentioned that once you're on the ground, once you're here and in the communities, you're seeing so much color and the color is everywhere. So I'm curious, as you were starting your career in painting, you know, to what extent that those surroundings that we had growing up of the brown landscape, of the desert landscape, to maybe outsiders, it might have seemed devoid of color. How much did that inspire your art to be as bright as it is?
Dude, that's truly, that story is perfect because that's everything for me. That story alone really informs and kind of is a current that runs through all my work and was an intention I took early on when I first started painting and started selling and exhibiting more work around town in a more serious way. I was like, okay, well, what's my real intention here with the work? What does that mean? How do I impart more meaning into the work? And really it came from that exact kind of story that you told. From above, you're right. It's brown, it's dirt, it's mountain. And people from here, not from here, they see that and that sticks with them in that kind of way. Even our local state government doesn't really think of us. They think of us as the dirt mountain town far away. But there's real truth to getting up close and personal to the city, getting up close and personal to the culture, to the community, to the people, to the area, to really experience what the beauty of the desert really is and what the beauty of El Paso and its culture and its people really are. You have to get in it, step into the mountain instead of looking at it from above. And so early on, I thought, okay, well, if I'm going to keep painting, how can I impart joy through the work? And how can I try to make a new impression, a new first impression for the border for others, whether you're from here or not from here? To my cousins that left as soon as they could because they didn't like it, to the people that are living here and that see the beauty or maybe that don't see it. And so the color story was kind of inherent in what I like to do. I mean, when I first started painting, I love color. I love vibrancy and brightness. And I think that's the influence of driving around town, around Alameda and seeing the murals, seeing the bright, colorful signs painted on buildings. I also love graphic work, graphic novels, video games. I like art and advertising. I just like bright stuff. And so it really became an intentional choice of how can I focus on those things about El Paso that are often forgotten and bring them new life and new color and show others the vibrancy I see. Because I really, truly believe there's this like raw, vibrant, creative pulse to El Paso, to Juarez, to the area, because we're on our own. If we don't do it here, no one's going to do it. And that's the same everywhere, but I think there's also this like really rawness, this kind of creative pulse here. And so that was kind of my first intention with the work was like, how can I spread joy? How can I encourage others to look closely? So a lot of my work, even still, is focused on the plant life and the place. My work is about place. It's about the people here, the plants here, the mountains here, because it's important to remind myself of the beauty here and to show others what I see so that when they think of El Paso and they think of the mountain, they think about getting in it. And they look for that little green prickly pear that you might have ignored the 100 times you've walked by it. But in the spring, when you get close and it flowers, you'll see how beautiful it is. And from that, I found more inspiration and more meaning for the prickly pear for me. I mean, I guess it's to a lot of artists or people that are from the desert, maybe it's a cliche, who knows? But to me, it's very important because the prickly pear means so much. I consider them portraits that I paint of the desert people. Prickly pears, there's none the same as the next one. And they grow in the craziest places, on roofs, in gutters, in sidewalks. And they are not to be forgotten or stepped on, just like us here. We will make our presence known. We'll prick you back if you step on us. We bloom brightly, man. That's like, it might not be forever. It might not be for long, but when we have our opportunity, we shine. And yeah. So early on, I kind of adopted this like mantra that I repeat to myself daily. I put it on all my stuff that I make, and it's very important to me, is to stay sharp, be prickly and to bloom brightly. That kind of informs my work in the courtroom and informs my work on the panel or on canvas or on a wall, where it's like, all right, how can we, as El Pasoans and people on the border, stay sharp to the realities around us and be ready and aware for the stories people put on us, the narrative that is often tried to blanket over us? How can we stay sharp to fight back? How can we be prepared? How can we be prickly? Which people always ask me, like, hey, the be prickly part, what's up with that? Like, I get stay sharp and bloom brightly, but what's up with be prickly? Well, when you're from here or you're from any marginalized community, you get stepped on, you get tired of it. And so the prickly pair, well, we got to fight back. You know, if someone's going to step on you, make sure that they remember next time and you get a little bit of them on your own, like the prickly pear does. You know, if you're hiking in the mountain, you got to pay attention to the prickly pear because they'll wreck you. And I feel that way kind of about us, you know.
I love that. So we are like the representation, those of us who grew up here.
Yeah, it's like, hey, El Paso is this or it's that. It's like, hey, man, what's up? Like, and in the courtroom, I tell to myself too, it's like, hey, you know, you're fighting opposing counsel. Sometimes that means you're arguing with your client, you're arguing with the DA, and you're arguing with the judge and maybe the probation department. You got to be on your toes. You got to be prickly. You got to fight back. You got to not be afraid to stand up in more ways than one, personally, and then also my work in the courtroom. And then, of course, bloom brightly is kind of more obvious, right? When you get your opportunity, stand up. And I feel that way about us. I feel that way about El Paso. And I try to do that through my work so that when people see the work and the pieces that I do, they'll feel a sense of pride, a sense of joy, whether that's on your wall, in a museum, or on your fridge. Hopefully that color story can breathe kind of new life. That's kind of what I see the art's goal in its current form for me.
It's beautiful. And I encourage folks to go look at your art. And I think you're right in terms of what I have seen, and I'm curious from your perspective as an artist, is how you would describe the current art scene in El Paso. I only moved back in October of 2024 after not living here permanently for 20 years. And I've noticed there's so many studios, including yours now, that have opened, but you have artists like Gabriel Marquez, Mystic Desert. You have spaces that have opened up like the Falstaff, but also so many artists here making names for themselves like Dino Ortega, Diego Martinez, Kristen Apodaca. You'll see their work all over the city, often in murals too. And I know it's hard to lock in artists into any sort of box, but is there a movement that you can feel as an artist among other artists around you that are representing the city?
I do. I mean, and I feel that it's been building for years. I mean, the history of amazing creators here in El Paso is long and deep and goes on for generations. But this current generation and the next upcoming, it's this, the connective tissue for me is this kind of raw attitude in the work where everyone is so different, as it should be. But often when I travel, as someone who loves art, there are certain art communities or enclaves where you notice, maybe because I'm paying attention, where some of the work like starts to bleed together and there's kind of a connected story of the creative spirit in a place. That does not exist here. There is no connected like theme other than I'm doing what I want to do in a big, bold way. And I think it comes directly from us being our own island out here in the desert. You know, collectors from Austin or Marfa or Santa Fe aren't coming here. And so if you're going to make art, you better make whatever it is you want to make. Because there's just this like raw passion that I love most about the artists that live and create in El Paso. I have lists of my favorite ones, and that goes from artists that are showing at the Mexican American Cultural Center or the Museum of Art, like Mariano Olague, or the artist like Alexis, who sets up weekend shops and sells her prints on different merch. Like everyone is just pushing their creative spirit forward in a way that's been historically and accepted by the community, because there's art everywhere. Not this notion of like being an artist is less than being an artist here in El Paso means something, because artists have community meaning and have for generations. So there's just this like acceptance and encouragement here that breeds just more art, just more people doing more things. Yeah, artists just kind of kicking the door down and doing whatever it is they want, whenever they want, in the way they like creatively, which just breeds for this like ripple effect of passion. I mean, I look at artists every day and what they're working on, and it's a constant inspiration to be like, man, you mentioned Kristen. She does everything. And every time I look at her work, I'm just always so blessed to be creating at the same time she is, and to be somewhat of a contemporary of hers and a friend, more importantly, but a creative contemporary of hers, to be like, man, she's doing it. She's always working, and she's doing whatever it is she wants to do in this like raw kind of way, with this kind of tenacious attitude through the work. And so that exists all over town, man. Like, it exists in Gaspar Enriquez and his old works that are accepted, you know, in the Smithsonian, and it exists with the young artists at the Falstaff making their own spaces and their own names. And I think the younger artists are learning what we learned too not too long ago, where it's like, hey man, if we want to have art shows, we got to do them, because there's no galleries, there's no collectors that are trying to build a young emerging artist crew to support and fund. If you want to sell your work, you got to get out and do it.
Absolutely. And I've noticed that too, that there's people out there hustling. But I'm curious, because some of those artists I name might have a little bit more recognition in the city because their pieces are commissioned either by the city or by buildings or by companies. And have you noticed that there has been an influx of companies or buildings that want more local art like that? I mean, if you look at Lincoln Park, for example, some of the murals there, if you look downtown, there's paintings by local artists all over. Has there been more of a welcoming scene from the city and from companies here?
Yeah, I mean, in my experience so far as an artist living and creating, it's been incredible to see how committed everyday El Pasoans are to celebrating local art, how committed our local businesses are, how committed our city government is, our county government, in when they think of, hey, we need art for something, they don't run to one of your big giant stores to buy something. They reach out to local artists. And when there's an event that's community forward, they think of local artists. And MCAD, which is like the city's Museum and Cultural Affairs Department, they do incredible work supporting local artists, providing grants just so people can maybe pay rent for a couple months and focus on painting instead of hustling. They do this like citywide art buying program every couple of years where they buy original pieces from artists living and working here in El Paso. They support local artists in the galleries that we do have, like the official, like, you know, the Mexican American Cultural Center or the Museum of Art, by featuring local artists that are young or that have been around forever, that, you know, aren't probably getting a call from museums in LA or Chicago or wherever. And so we're blessed, man. Like, I get calls often from different places looking for art, and it's incredible that they think local. And I think it just comes from that history of being in El Paso. And when you drive around or you've lived in the city, you've seen work by Frederick Carter, Tom Lee, Hal Marcus, Gaspar, Mora, the list goes on of local artists that have been around forever. So that when they think like, hey, I want to put art in my new dentist office, they're like, ah, well, I could buy some like pastel flowers from Target or Home Goods or whatever, or I can spend an extra $100 and buy a bunch of pieces from Diego Robot, and it's going to matter. You're going to have a sense of place and the creativity and the rawness of what El Paso is. You're going to show your clients and your customers and the people that come through your space that you believe in supporting local artists. You're going to inspire the future generations when they look up on the wall and they see a big Hal Marcus piece and they ask, oh, well, where did this piece of art come from? And you can turn around and say, oh, that's from Hal Marcus. His studio is up the street. You know, he's lived in downtown forever. Or, I mean, the list goes on of artists you can name. It's really incredible. I mean, I got so lucky to start painting when I did, and then to start doing it in a place that accepts that kind of work and gives it a level of respect that you might not find other places.
And in terms of your own work, it's featured in the airport. So folks who are flying into El Paso, maybe for the first time, might see your work. And that's got to feel pretty cool, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's pretty sick. Never gets old, man. Like, I mean, when anyone shares my work or like buys a pair of socks or buys a t-shirt or a piece or whatever, like, I love it, man. It never gets old for me. And the artwork in the airport, I hope it's there forever. I don't know when they're going to take it down. But I'm just so glad that people enjoy seeing it. And it's been there long enough now that people will tag me in photos like, hey, I know I'm home because I see the art. I'm welcomed by the cactus paintings that are here. And I get a lot of photos. People tag me when they're maybe dropping their family off because there's a bunch right there on the drop-off zone. And they take pictures in front of them. And it's like the coolest thing that when people think of El Paso art, I get to be part of that conversation because I started and moved here just as a fan of art, like fan of the artists here. Like when I first met Los Dos, who are this great husband and wife artist team with pieces all over the world, I met them as a fan, you know, just trying to buy a print and seeing how I could support them because I love their work. And so it's incredible now for me to be like, hey, people, when they meet me, they're like, oh, dude, I love your work. I've been following it. I like the new change, or I like what you're doing. I have this print in my house, or I have this at my office. And it's just, it's so cool. It's like the coolest thing ever, man.
That's been incredible to see your rise. I've been following your work for several years now. To the point that you're making about so much pride in El Paso, do you ever feel any pressure or worry about becoming a representational artist, that you're carrying that flag for El Paso artists, maybe unwillingly or willingly?
No, I don't feel any pressure to like carry a torch or a flag for the region because I'm so in awe of like all the other artists that are out here doing it. So I don't feel any pressure creatively. I mean, so I guess a little bit, just to be like a good representation of who we are. So when people think of El Paso, they think of the good things, but that's kind of beyond me too. And I try and also point people in the other direction. Like, hey man, you don't like my work. It's kind of boring or derivative or whatever. According to you, well, go find someone else, man. There's so many great creators here. Like, don't, you know, if you don't like my cactus work, I'm not doing it for you. Don't buy my work. Go buy from Kristen. Go support Franchella. Gabriel Marquez, like you said, or Tino or whatever. Find someone you love and support them. And because there's so many creators that represent El Paso to me and what we are here, yeah, I don't feel any pressure at all. Yeah, I'm just one of many. I'm just lucky they're my friends. And I'm lucky I get to be kind of in the boat, you know?
I'll say, I think it might have been the first piece that I saw of yours, but it's certainly one that I go back to often and speaks to me on many levels, is the one of the migrant family crossing the river with the moonlight shining on them. So it's obviously making like a political statement, but it's also something that I feel would resonate with folks from the border. So how do you process that as you're coming up with a piece like that, that maybe a little bit more loudly has a political message behind it?
Yeah, I kind of believe everything is political, especially here in El Paso, whether you mean it to be or not, whether it's in your face or not. You know, painting a big portrait. I think of the work by Mariana Olague, who's an incredible artist. She's got work that's just incredible. Mainly she paints a lot of paintings of her family members, her dad, herself working on a car, her sister, whatever. And her painting a big portrait of her sister working at the Dollar General, whatever, with the baby formula behind her, behind a lock key next to the cigarettes, is political to me. Just reflecting what's life is like here is political. Driving across I-10 and looking over to your left and seeing Mexico, and to your right and seeing downtown El Paso, to me is political. It shows the huge chasm between culture and economies and worlds, but also it shows the connectedness, the ridiculousness of borders. And one of my favorite pieces I painted years ago was of the border highway that kind of goes over the fence downtown, right? They built that extension that literally the pillars, people think they're in Mexico because they're on the other side of the fence.
Right.
And people are like, oh, how could you paint the fence? Because it's in there. I'm like, well, that's the reality of here. Like, they're like, ah, you're political with your work. I'm like, I don't know, man. This is a reality. This is a family history here. This is our story. People crossing the border is our history. People looking for better life is our history. And it's an everyday occurrence here. I don't know how you could ignore it, even if you tried really hard. I mean, the border makes you confront the ridiculousness of this kind of like binary thinking, because here on the border, we're everything at once. We're Mexico, we're El Paso, we're Chihuahua, we're New Mexico, we're American, we're Mexican. We're here, we're there, but we're not either. We're like the river, man. It cuts through, it changes, it makes a new path. And the artwork is like that here too. It's not just my work that's flora focused and sunset focused, or maybe political in the way you think, but it's giant portraiture, it's massive landscapes, it's detailed pieces, it's abstract expressionism. It's everything all at once, all the time.
I've often said that El Paso is truly the best representation of a city that we can have. And I actually love the fact that it is the first point of contact for so many people the world over, including myself. I had never been to the U.S. until my family came here when I was 4. And it was my introduction to America, and it was all I knew at that point. And I didn't know it at the time, but it was incredible. And I'm incredibly lucky and grateful to have grown up here, to have experienced so much, and also to have left, I think, and also learn more about myself now and wanting to reconnect with what it means to be from the border in 2026 now. So yeah, I'm incredibly blessed in that way as well. Before my final question, I wanted to give you a chance also to plug your work and let folks know where they might be able to find your work and if they're interested in buying it.
Yeah, my name is Patrick Gabaldon, G-A-B-A-L-D-O-N. That's key because all my stuff is Gabaldon art. My website, gabaldonart.com, my Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, Gmail, gabaldonart@gmail. And yeah, I always invite people, yeah, come find my work, follow it. Every bit helps keep the art dream alive. And like I said, if my work's not for you, I'll give you a list of amazing El Paso artists that are killing it. And you can find someone to support and someone to kind of bring color into your world. If it's not me, that's cool.
No, I love that. And the final question. If someone has never been to El Paso and only knows the border through the headlines that they read, what would you want your art to teach that person in 15, 20 seconds?
I would hope it would teach them to release that narrative that someone else gave them, to go out and make their own story. Go out and meet the people yourself. Go out to downtown, take a drive and scenic, go to some restaurants, meet some people. And you'll learn really quickly how the narratives that other people try to cover El Paso with are just not it. They're just not, that's not the reality of what this place is. And you'll find that, you know, there's a million stories because it's everything all the time. It's all these different things.
No, that's exactly right. And thank you so much, Patrick, for your time. Really appreciate this conversation.
Thanks. No, I appreciate it. It's always fun to think and talk about this kind of stuff.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
You got it. Thank you, man. Adios.
And that was my conversation with Patrick Gabaldon, artist and lawyer here in El Paso. And I hope that you found it meaningful and that it made you think in a new way about how a city's history, both the good and the challenging, is so intertwined with its art and its artists. I also hope that it's provided you a renewed sense of art as resilience and resistance. And hopefully, wherever you're listening from, I hope that it's encouraged you to seek out the art in your cities and in your neighborhoods, and to support those who are keeping a record of place and time through their art. And I hope it's maybe encouraged you to even come and check out El Paso for yourself and come see what life is like on the edge here for us. And that's it for this episode. I want to thank you all again for listening and being on this journey with me. And I hope you'll join us for our final episode of Borderly next week. This is Mario Carrillo, host of Borderly, a project of Immigrantly. And this episode was produced by Sadia Khan, editorial review by Shay Yu, sound design, theme music, and editing by Lou Raskin, and other music by Epidemic Sound. See y'all next week.